Welcome back to Forum. In his solitary travels, Tom Lutz seeks out places where he doesn't know anyone or speak the language. And his latest book, Drinking Mare's Milk on the Roof of the World, depicts encounters with people across the globe, from a casino in Tanzania to disputed parts of Ukraine. And along the way, Tom Lutz seeks to understand his compulsion to travel down the unfamiliar path. He's the founder and editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Review of Books. He joins us in studio for this hour, and good to see you again. Welcome.
Thanks, Michael. Glad to be here again.
Well, you are really trying to grapple with this whole question of what compels you as a wanderlust, shall we say, rabid wanderlust, compulsive of sorts. I mean, it's really extraordinary how many countries you've been to. I guess 100 notches on you, maybe even 115 at this point in counting?
About 127, depending on how you count. Yeah.
And more even since the book has been written.
Exactly.
It's fascinating. What gives people this wanderlust and what sets them? You try to get into that with the beginning with your little red wagon.
Yeah. You know, I guess a lot of people run away from home. But I do remember that as a great adventure. It lasted, I think, 11 minutes, but it was still a turning point.
You've been looking for those kind of adventures ever since, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I think that there was something about the time that I was coming of age. It was a restless culture. It was a time when everybody was hitchhiking around the country.
The hippie era you're talking about later on after you took your little red wagon.
It's another 10 years later, but. You remember this, Michael, where the streets were lined with hitchhikers everywhere. And I used to hitchhike randomly. I would just get – people would say, where are you going? I would say, where are you going? And take them as far as they went.
Well, you also took a minister's daughter on the back of a motorbike. that was a serious odyssey and began some of your seminal travels, yeah?
Yeah. Her parents ended up in Switzerland for a year I always feel terrible whenever I think about, at the time it felt glorious to be driving off with Susie on the back of my bike. But I keep thinking about how her parents must have felt. I was not a trustworthy human being at that point in my life.
You have since morphed and matured, obviously. You were doing a lot of freight train hopping. I mean, there was always this restlessness, as you characterized it. And it's marked pretty seriously in this book, even taking note of how many states you had traveled. We got to 47. What were the three you didn't get to?
Well, Louisiana, oddly enough, as a roots musician, I just thought, I'll always get there, of course, and to New Orleans. And Alaska took a while, and Hawaii took a little while.
So you've covered all 50 now?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. And even more countries, as I said, since the book has been written. But the writing of this book came out of you quote Pico Iyer, one of the great travel writers, as saying, in effect, the stillness that you want to have once you've done the travel is what creates the ability to put it on the page.
Yes. Eventually one stops. And that happens during the trip as well. Sometimes you just get back to a hotel room and sit down and everything comes to a halt and you reflect. And that's what writing, of course, is good for. And it's what writing needs. I mean, I do take notes as I'm wandering around. I find that the thing that I need most is to record the way people speak, the very specific way that people speak. That's the thing that disappears if I don't note it down and take notes right away. But otherwise, the stories, of course, remain for years and years. Some of these I didn't write for 10 years after the trip itself.
Some of these are great stories. And let me give the exact Pico Iyer quote. Wherever you go I thought I had it here. Wrong page. Maybe you can give it to us because I'm sort of hunting for it here.
Okay.
Oh, wait a minute. I found it. I'm sorry.
Okay.
So we travel until we come home, and then if we're lucky at home, in stillness we write. And you're writing a lot about writing. I mean, being a literary guy, it's hard to avoid The Open Road and Whitman and talking about Kerouac and all of that. How much did that inform your own travel? How much did it inspire your own travel?
Well, it's interesting. I think that there's something in the culture that that is larger than the the writing itself, because I was acting like I was Jack Kerouac before I had read Jack Kerouac. I was pretending to be him without having actually read him. And
Hemingway said it all goes back to Huckleberry Finn, right?
Exactly.
All American literature, and this is lighting out for the territory.
Exactly. And I do think that I'm not sure I had even read Huckleberry Finn at that point. I was pretty much of a complete numbskull when I was starting out.
You're giving quite a portrait of your youth.
Irresponsible numbskull. That's the title of my autobiography, I suppose.
Possible. Well, but the fascination in this is just the chance meetings and not knowing. You're sort of depending often on the kindness of strangers because you didn't know the language. It's really sort of derring do in many ways to go on these jaunts to places that are far off and remote and sometimes maybe even a little sinister. But meeting people and often meeting, some pretty terrific and fascinating people.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that what I've tried to do, the second volume of these travels is now out as well. One of the things I've tried to do is keep reimagining why it is that I'm so driven. And I've come up with a number of theories as I've gone along, but the one that seems to be the most enduring is that I am addicted to this kind of accidental intimacy on the road. This idea, this way in which, because I'm just passing through, and because people know they're never going to see me again, we can talk. We can get to a level of talk about life very quickly.
It's like strangers on a train type
exactly,
of phenomenon. Yeah.
Exactly.
And the titles, the new one is And the Monkey Learned Nothing, the book we've been sort of focusing on, Drinking Mare's Milk on the Roof of the World. Can you sort of annotate those titles for us?
Well, the first one, Drinking Mare's Milk on the Roof of the World, is I think of as the most fun story in a way. In the first book is about doing a trip across the Silk Road. I started in Uzbekistan and I went through the great old Silk Road cities in Uzbekistan and then up into the mountains of Kyrgyzstan and across the Roof of the World, which has been called since the Persians came through, and into Western China. And that was the only way to get across is to, it's not exactly hitchhiking because you come to a price with somebody to take you as far as they can go. And truckers mostly at that point. And it was the trucker that took me the farthest was drinking mare's milk, which is a fermented beverage all the way along. And that made him, I think it made it possible for him to take the risks that were necessary to get the truck across what weren't really roads anymore. They were trails because the road had washed out too many times. And the truckers had to kind of keep finding new routes like a skier. And so it was a kind of frightening and exhilarating trip.
And the monkey learned nothing?
yeah, of course, the monkey, c'est moi, as Flaubert said. That's a bit about how much I detest monkeys. Monkeys kind of patrol most of the great temples in various parts of Southeast Asia, and extract tolls from passersby, or just throw feces at them. They're a nasty, nasty animal. I think that they're basically sociopathic.
Oh, you're going to get some monkey lovers here who take issue with you. But I like that story about the German tourist with the bananas. Can you tell that?
Yeah, this was in Bali, up on at the end of the far, far southeastern tip of the island. There's a great temple at the top of a long hill. You have to climb up hundreds of stairs to get to it. And at the top, and everybody buys bananas to feed the monkeys. And this German tourist had been kind of like teasing a monkey and pulling the banana back just as the monkey swung by to grab it. And the monkey thought, okay. And just grabbed the glasses off of this guy's face. And the glasses were like architect's glasses, like artist's glasses. They were expensive. You could just tell looking at them, very stylish. And the German really needed them. He was blinking and clearly upset. And the monkey sat on a branch, completely aware of where he was, where he is completely aware of his advantage in this situation. And the man started pleading with him and offering bananas, offering whole bunches of bananas. and kind of walking the monkey through a kind of hostage negotiation.
We're going to do a quid pro quo here. Right?
Exactly. And eventually they got closer and closer, and finally the monkey kind of he knew what the deal was supposed to be, handing the glasses back, and then he just grabbed the bananas away from the guy, went back, still holding the glasses, looked at him once, looked at the tourist, and just tossed him over his shoulder, where they went down, you know, about 6 or 8 stories worth of down into the surf below at the bottom of the island. And I just thought the monkey just, he knew exactly what he was doing. He was so, it was culture. It was not just the
simian
act.
Culture.
Yeah. Not just the act. It was a kind of memorialization of the act. It was a kind of representation of the relationship they had. It was a beautiful and horrifying glimpse into the mind of the monkey.
That'll teach you to monkey around as a monkey business or whatever. We're talking to Tom Lutz, who is editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Review of Books. And we're talking about his book, Drinking Mare's Milk on the Roof of the World, and the newer book, And the Monkey Learned Nothing. And are you a travel addict? And what draws you to the open road? I'd like to hear from some of you about not only traveling, and if you have a travel addiction, as Tom obviously does, you can talk about it and let us know about it, but also be interested in hearing some stories from listeners about, because Tom's book is full of these stories, exotic travels and encounters that were ephemeral and maybe anecdotal, but surprised you as you were perhaps not necessarily a tourist, but just traveling. He calls them indelible brief encounters, and that's a good way to think of them. We all know what we're talking about here. I mean, in Tom's case, some pretty amazing experiences, including being held by the police in Azerbaijan, looking as a possible husband or mate in Swaziland. I mean, there's some real adventurous stories here. I'd be interested in hearing some of yours. We'll talk more about some of his. But in the meantime, let me open the phone lines and invite you to join us. Do you think there is such a thing as a travel addiction, by the way? Do you think, you know, there's a real compulsion to travel that perhaps afflicts you? It may not be an affliction. It may, in fact, be a wonderful way to learn about the world as a global traveler. Anyway, I'm going to open the phone lines and invite your participation. The toll-free number to call is 866-733-6786. You can join us now. A lot of exotic travel stories in Tom's book. You may have one or two that you want to tell us in a cogent way about. 866-733-6786 is the number to call, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. You can also, of course, go to our Facebook page, but please feel free to participate in the program. And there were a few scary moments. I mean, this is not all roses in your travels.
No, although, you know, it is amazing to me that I go to places where I'm carrying the average annual income of the people in my backpack between a, you know, not a great camera, but a good camera, and incredibly expensive computer, but a computer, and I just and an iPhone. It's just I'm always surprised at how safe almost everywhere I go is. There are moments where
except places in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, well, the U.S. as well. I mean, I've traveled the mean streets of this country, and it is remarkably safe. And I mean, just if you look at the actuarial tables, there's just not that much crime. Obviously, crime is horrible, and violent crime is horrible, and it happens. But the thing I walk away from all of these travels with is how decent and helpful and hospitable and friendly and wonderful 99% of the people in the world are.
What was it you dislike so much about Moldavia?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, exoticism is kind of a bad word these days, that we understand the kind of colonialist roots of thinking about other peoples as exotic. But the fact is that I am looking for difference on the road. I am looking for places that are not like where I'm from, and for people that are not like me. And Moldova, when I arrived, I realized I can pass for Moldovan. It's a country full of just nondescript looking white people. And
is it Moldova, not Moldavia? I've heard both.
Moldova, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And I was very interested in going to Transnistria, which is a kind of breakaway province of Moldova, still very much under Russian influence, and has been for – it's part of the League of Unrecognized Nations. And that was my real goal, was to get to Transnistria. Transnistria is just like Moldova, except that there are some Russian tanks parked around the streets. But otherwise, it's exactly the same. So it was – and nobody was interested in talking to me, kind of like trying to start a conversation on the street corner in New York. It's people looked at me funny rather than finding me of interest because I was different. I just looked like them, and they wanted to know why this crazy person was trying to have a conversation with them.
So you felt you wrote that you felt invisible there. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. I did not matter.
Talking to author and editor in chief of the Los Angeles Review of Books, Tom Lutz, who is, shall we say, a man of pathological wanderlust, and has made that evident in his writings. Let's find out what you, our listeners, have had in the way of travel experiences, and let's begin with Paul. Paul, you're on.
Hi, Mr. Lutz. I just wanted to ask how you've seen the brand of the United States kind of change, and the reaction to it change, you know, over the last 20 years as we've expanded our, you know, influence over the world, as we always have. And I've seen it in my own time. 21 short years, but I've seen it change dramatically. How have you seen it?
Well, that's a great question, because I've been astounded how little any kind of righteous indignation at U.S. actions translates into the way people on the street think about an individual American. So even in Iran, for instance, people were incredible. They would ask me where I was from. I'd say the USA. Oh, we love America. People are very good, I think, especially if they live under bad regimes. They're very good at separating out what a government does from what its citizenry might be like. And so in Laos, where we dropped – the U.S. dropped more bombs than have ever been dropped on any country in history, even until today. People were very happy to see me and very, very happy to talk about America and liked America. And didn't I asked, why don't you just hate us? And I get a number of different answers to that question.
It's fascinating to me, and always has been, how hated Americans are in – not entirely by any means, but in certain parts of the Middle East, you know, they created 9/11 out of Saudi Arabia, Yemen, places like that. But in Central America, where we have behaved very badly, to put it mildly, mm-hmm. or in Vietnam, you know, there's kind of a welcoming and warmth toward Americans. You talk about the transparent eyeball. I'd like to get you to talk about that a little bit more. I guess it goes back to Emerson, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's an idea that the transcendentalists had, that and Emerson, I remember it as a cartoon from one of the Transcendentalist journals in the 1840s, of just an eyeball on two long legs, a kind of cartoon. The idea was that somehow if you could just get rid of your ego — a lot of the Transcendentalists were reading Eastern philosophy, Hindu scripture, and that kind of thing — you could get rid of your ego, you could get rid of your kind of sense of self, and just be a pure perceptual machine, that was the height of — that's the best way to be in the world. And I felt that maybe that was what drove me to travel, that I could kind of slough off my whole myself and be open to the world when I was out in the middle of nowhere in a brand new place. And I do find that I forget myself in important ways. I am perceiving where I am. And so for a while I thought, well, that's exactly why I like to travel. I like to have this Zen moment where my sense of self disappears into an appreciation of the world.
Here's Adam, who writes, "It kills me that only about 35% of Americans hold a passport. I wonder what percentage has an opinion about world affairs." And Debbie tweets, "Does Tom Lutz think young people who have been raised by helicopter parents are as likely as he was to travel the world solo?"
There's two very good questions. I mean, the 35% of people who don't hold passports include everybody who can't even afford the passport fee, much less to travel, right? So, and I'm very aware at all times of the incredible privilege that I have, partly because I had kids young and they're all on their own, fully adult at this point. But partly because I've got a nice job and I've got a reasonable income. I can do this. So it's partly that people are not interested in traveling, but it's partly that that those of us with the privilege to do so often do.
And there were places that you were impressed by, Belarus, for example, that normally people don't find all that impressive in terms of general travel writing or the sorts of things you've encountered of other writers. Yeah.
Yeah, Belarus is one of those places that, I mean, it's actually physically quite beautiful, but not in a sublime way. It's just pine forests and mountain lakes, but not big mountains. And so it doesn't make a great calendar shot. But the people were very interesting and smart and nice. Belarus, by the way, produces more computer programmers than any country per capita.
Who would have known that little fact, huh?
Yeah.
You want to talk about how you were looked at as husband material in Swaziland?
Sure. I mean, it's. I think that Swaziland is not alone in this. That is a rich, single looking. That is, I wear a wedding ring, so I'm not. I think anybody that wanted to figure it out could. But a man rich enough to travel through a far flung place on his own attracts some attention. Sometimes that attention is from prostitutes, and sometimes it's just from people who are see an opportunity to maybe go somewhere else. So we just having dinner one night, and a couple women asked if I would join them, and I did, and we had a great conversation. It was all fun, and I realized partway through that there was a woman and her aunt, and I realized partway through that the aunt was interested in helping her niece move from the marriage that she was in to upgrade a little bit.
Let's bring some more of our callers on, and we go next to Seanad. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm from San Rafael, and I totally understand the travel addiction thing. I spent a lot of time traveling all over the world alone and eventually felt like I need more and more challenges. And I decided to go to Mongolia because it was the most sparsely populated country in the world. And I wound up walking across Mongolia alone.
Fantastic.
Wow. Yeah. What about, we keep reading how it's harder for women to travel by themselves. I mean, were you apprehensive even in a place like Mongolia?
No, I don't agree with that it's hard for women to travel by themselves. I've always traveled alone. I've hitchhiked in Eastern Europe. I've, like I said, I walked across Mongolia alone, and I really find that when you meet local people, they're always very welcoming, and they want you to be successful, and a lot of people take pride in their culture and their country, and they really want you to have a good experience in their country, and that was certainly true in Mongolia. People in the countryside were so thrilled to see me that they invited me into their home, they served me meals, they fed me tea, and sent me on my way. And so I find that people are very hospitable.
And you still have the wanderlust, so to speak?
Well, I have a child now, so I'm a parent, which has curtailed my travel somewhat. But my son and I still went traveling when he was young and still go traveling now, just in not the adventurous style that I did when I was single.
Well, it's good of you to call, and I hope maybe once you have a little bit of an emptier nest, you can get out to that open road again. Thank you for the call. Tom, a lot of people are fellow travelers with you. I mean, they share this, call it an addiction to travel, yeah?
Yeah. You know, I call it an addiction as a way to fend off the charges of overprivileged, quasi-imperialist wandering around the globe. I do understand it to a certain extent to be an addiction, but I also am so happy that I'm doing it, as the last caller was. I'm really happy to hear her talk about women travelers, because people ask me that a lot, and I'm going to use her from now on as my exhibit A for why women should do it as well.
And let me give some exhibits B and C, at least of some comments that are coming in here. Ben writes, because I had asked about travels, and Ben says, recently I was in Istanbul and invited to break the Ramadan fast with a group of locals. It was one of the more genuine interactions we had during our trip. Dan writes, I agree with the concept of seeking out difference when one travels. It's why I've focused on Asia and Latin America, though I've only recently visited Cuba and Istanbul. If I'm the only person speaking English in a restaurant, I consider that a win. And we'll get Allison
too.
On here.
Me too.
Allison, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I work in a coffee shop, and I have maybe 600 customers a day. And I think some people need to travel in order to feel freer because they feel anonymous. No one knows who they are, or don't worry about being seen again. But I can have deeply intimate conversations with people that I see for a few minutes. I think part of it is being curious and eager or enthusiastic and open. So I also know some people who are addicted to travel who aren't comfortable being alone, aren't comfortable with themselves. And they always have to think that by changing their environment, they're changing themselves, but they're really not. They come home to themselves.
Yeah, that's something else that Ralph Waldo Emerson said. You know, you take you wherever you go, and
yes.
I'm paraphrasing. But what about that eagerness and enthusiasm and openness? Maybe people have been kind and generous to you because you've been open and eager.
It's very possible. I mean, I do think that you know, Wally Shawn in my dinner with Andre, they have this exact conversation where Andre is talking about